just say there's a reason some hymns are obscure. And if you're watching this on YouTube, it's a hymn I wrote. I'm allowed to say things like that. So I'd never heard that hymn before in our congregation. And now I kind of have. Kind of. All of our holy days, well, one of the things that makes our holy days rich and colorful is that they all have stories attached to them. One of the interesting things about Passover and unleavened bread is we have two story threads going on for those holy days. And one, of course, is the story of Moses and the people of Israel who are leaving Egypt. And the second is the story of Jesus Christ and how he was the true Passover lamb and the events that led up to his sacrifice. When we come together for Passover, we emphasize the second story. We emphasize Jesus Christ, which is how it should be, because Passover was always about Jesus Christ, even in the book of Exodus, whether it's clear or not. Traditionally, on the night to be much observed, which we come together for a meal and to remember how God has delivered us from both physical and spiritual Egypt, we tend to tell and dwell on the first story thread, the Exodus story, which has better special effects and is, you know, more fun for children to read and things like that. It's a rip-roaring story. And before the Passover, of course, it's important, and we do this in services and we do it in the privacy of our own spiritual lives. It's important to review both the story threads. And I depend that you have done that. And I even in our church, you know, I assume that you know the story of Jesus Christ and his sacrifice, and I assume that you know the story of Moses and his colorful life and how he and the children of Israel left Egypt. And interestingly enough, you know, there's some parts of our faith that we don't share with the rest of the world, but the world knows these stories. The world knows the stories of Moses, and they know the story of Jesus. So I am going to assume that you know those stories and talk about something that runs parallel to the first thread and how it ties into the second thread. And today, this is the story of how God made Moses. Mr. Thomas last week in his sermon talked a great deal, and I probably won't get the wording correct. I wanted to check it, but it wasn't on YouTube yet. But that God has in all of our lives, in the lives of every person that he calls from the beginning of time till now, has worked out little details in our life from birth on in some cases in ways that we may see clearly, but we might not know. There's a lot that God has done for us that is for his benefit, and we might not even be aware of it, but it's affected our own lives. And one of the fun things in the world tomorrow will be to find out all the tweaking and string pulling that God did for us in those times. But he did a lot for Moses. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 34. Sorry, sound people, I wrote down Exodus, but it's Deuteronomy 34. And we'll see where Moses ended up. I'm not a good page turner, I'm sorry to say, and I will have to do a lot of page turning. In Deuteronomy 34, this is how Moses was described, starting in verse 10. "Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face." When God spoke to Moses, as he explained to Miriam and Aaron in the book of Numbers, Moses saw God's form. Moses saw a human form. Verse 11, "who did all the miraculous signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do in Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his officials and even to his whole land. For no one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of Israel." And that's where Moses ended up. In his last minutes, he gets an A++++++, but it was not always so. And he started out as a different kind of person, and we can see how he grows. There are three clear divisions in Moses' life. We read his story, of course, in the book of Exodus, but it's also recounted in Acts 7 by the deacon and prophet Stephen in the last 20 minutes of his life. he told the story of Moses, and it was said that his face was like an angel. He was speaking through the Holy Spirit, so we rely on that as factual. And there are also some references to the life of Moses in Hebrews 11, and we'll take all those into consideration. Thankfully, the math of Moses' life is easy. We know that he lived to be 120 years old. That's in verse chapter 34 of Deuteronomy. We know from the accounts that there were 40 years between the time of the burning bush and the time that Israel entered the promised land and Moses died. That was 40 years. So he was 80 at the time of the burning bush. We know that he left Egypt at age 40. So there's three 40-year periods. I love easy math. It's three 40-year periods. And we know how old he was when he was born. So there are three 40-year periods, and we'll take them one at a time because it's just an easy way to tackle it. In the first 40 years, God was involved, just as Mr. Thomas hinted about us all. God was involved from the very start. Did you know that? We think of God as meeting Moses in the burning bush, but God was aware of him before then. And in, let's turn to Acts 7. This is Stephen's account. Stephen is about to die, actually. He's been accused of wanting to destroy the temple. And if you read all of Acts 7, and I hope that you will, you'll see that Stephen is using the story of the first Passover, the actual lambs that were slaughtered, to tie in to the true story of the Passover, which was Jesus' death. But he goes a lot through the story of Moses. And one of the things that he says is in verse 20, he says, at the time Moses was born, he was no ordinary child. Now, I have a note in my New International Bible, and there's another way to translate these words. And we don't really know how they should be translated, but the other way is that the baby was fair in the sight of God. So God was noticing him even as a baby. Now, in Hebrews 11, when you read about Moses, it's actually Moses' parents who get into the faith chapter because they had the faith to keep Moses alive, even though the babies were supposed to be killed. But one of the interesting things, it says that his parents looked at him and saw that this was no ordinary child. Well, if you have children and you look at your baby, you might not use those words, but the thoughts go through your mind. This is no ordinary child. This is possibly the greatest child who has ever been born since her older sibling was born. You know, so we look at that, but it's codified in the book of Hebrews that Moses' parents were right. This was no ordinary child. And of course, it makes you wonder, and I have no answers for you, what they were looking at. I mean, he was a baby, and they said, this is no ordinary child. But I don't know, maybe he looked like Charlton Heston. I'm not sure. But there was something about Moses that from the very beginning made his parents want to save him. But also that God's eye was on him from the very start. Of course God was involved. Even if we didn't know that, of course he was involved. You don't put a baby in a basket in a river. They don't live. The basket turns over and you lose a baby at that point. But Moses was not lost. And who does he end up with? You send him down the river and you think, well, you know, some wino will pull him out. And it was the premier woman in all Egypt. She pulled him out, and he was rescued by the Pharaoh's daughter. And she looked at him, and she could tell he was a Hebrew baby. I don't want to go into that, but let's, from the time he was 8 days old, he no longer looked like an Egyptian. Let's put it that way. And but you know, Moses grew up, and he looked like and passed for an Egyptian prince. So racially, genetically, there must have been enough similarities there that Moses could pass as an Egyptian prince. And then, of course, as if that's not enough, you know the story. Somehow his big sister wangles it so that this baby, who is now not only saved from death but going to grow up in Pharaoh's court, gets nursed by his own mother. How is that even possible? And at that point, God thought, I should keep an eye on this Miriam person, because she clearly was an operator at that point. It was amazing. Somehow this little girl wangled it so that Moses received his own mother's breast milk in the house of Pharaoh. And, you know, Moses was 3 months old by the time that he was rescued by Pharaoh's daughter. And we don't really know his name. We have to think that his parents gave him a name sometime. I mean, if not in the first few days, they needed a name by the eighth day. And Moses was 3 months old. That's verified in a couple places in the Bible. And it was Pharaoh's daughter who named him Moses, which we think means drawn out. And it's a great name for a person who led the tribes of Israel out of Egypt at that point. So God was definitely involved. I mean, there were so many miracles about that. According to Stephen in Acts 7:22, he was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and interesting wording, he was mighty in word and deed. Mighty in word and deed. He was a well-spoken person, and he was an accomplished person. He was filled with the best knowledge that Egypt had. And, of course, Egypt went on, not at that time, to have one of the finest libraries in the world. So they were always a center of knowledge in the ancient world. He was filled with good knowledge and not so good knowledge from God's point of view. As I said, he must have looked the part. He must have been noble and looked like an Egyptian prince. Possibly he went out with Egypt's armies and traveled to the various parts of the lands that Egypt dominated at that point. He was proud. We know this because he thought he could get away with anything. Still, he knew who he was, and you get the feeling that it nagged at him a bit, because at age 40, he still knew who he was. I mean, maybe he stayed in touch with his birth parents at that point. I mean, the woman who was his nurse growing up, he wouldn't call her mother, probably, but he could possibly stay in touch with them, and they could remind him that he may be enjoying the best privileges that Egypt could offer, but that he was not one of them. And you know the story. He went out to visit and watch his people, and it all ended abruptly because he saw an Egyptian beat an Israelite, and he killed the Egyptian. And he thought, well, I mean, I'm guessing that he thought he could just get away with this. I am a prince of Egypt, and I can do this. Well, the Israelites must have known the story because they seemed to know that Moses was an Israelite, and the one man said, "Are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" And Moses was suddenly in trouble, and Pharaoh wanted to kill him at that point because he'd committed murder. He found out that all the things he'd thought about himself weren't true at that point, and he fled Egypt in fear of his life. It all ended abruptly. First 40 years, covered. Second 40 years, he fled to Midian. Midian is an interesting choice. Midian was probably a land on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba in what we call Saudi Arabia today. But wherever it was, it included Mount Horeb, which was the holy mountain, Mount Sinai, because Moses spent time there. Midian is a tricky word to pin down in the Bible because it, of course, applies to the Midianites. There are people, and the Midianites, sometimes they're okay people and sometimes they're not okay people. Sometimes they take Joseph into slavery, and sometimes Israel's at war with them, and at other times Moses flees to them and their friends. And Midian was a descendant of Abraham through his wife Keturah. So they had some things in common, but he not only fled to Midian, he fled to a man who had an incredible, with God still guiding, he fled to a man to exactly the right place, to the household and family of Reuel. And let's turn back to Exodus chapter 2 at this point. And from the Bible standpoint, it's all on one page for me. Exodus 2, starting in verse 11, and up till the end of chapter 2, which is verse 25, that's the whole second year's covered, the second 40 years covered. And yet, I would say that the second 40 years is the most important of the three in God making Moses into the person that he needed to meet at the burning bush. Moses was not that person at the very start. He was in the household and the family of Reuel, and of course that was a bit miraculous too. I think you know the story, but if you go down to verse 16, it just says, or verse 15, when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses, Mr. Mighty in word and deed, still a prince in his own mind, Moses got up and drove all the other shepherds away and came to their rescue and watered their flock. And then, for all we know, he sat down by the well again. And the girls went home and returned to rule their father. And he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" In other words, he was used to them having trouble. And they said, "Well, an Egyptian." So they didn't recognize him. He was dressed as an Egyptian. They didn't recognize him as an Israelite. "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." And Reuel said, "And where is he? Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." So they went back and got Moses. Moses agreed to stay with the man, one of the best decisions that he ever made. And soon, this is all the Reader's Digest version of Moses' life at this point, he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. So Moses, early on in that 40-year period, married into the family. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." And this was key to how Moses felt at that point. He was an outcast. He was an alien. He did not belong. Well, he tended his father-in-law's sheep for the next 40 years. And as I said, this was one of the most critical times in Moses' personal growth as a child of God. God was making a leader, and the biggest changes happened then. By the time of the burning bush, which was 40 years later, God was appearing to Moses and relating to him as a friend. He appeared to Moses face to face in person. Now, not necessarily as a human figure in the burning bush itself, but he had 40 years to make Moses into the person who would deliver Israel and be a true leader and have a close relationship with God. They related as friends. Now, Moses was a friend who drove God crazy at some times. Crazy isn't the best word to use to describe God, but let's say to distraction, because it was distracting. From this time to the very end of his life, even though he was devoted to God and he was the strong, humble leader that God was looking for, he still was always doing things that made God angry or made God rethink of this. And yet, we know what his mindset was at the beginning of the 40 years, and we also happen to know what it was at the end of the 40 years, so you can do subtraction and figure the difference. Let's turn to Hebrews 11 and verse 24. Hebrews 11 and verse 24, this describes Moses at the end of the 40 years. "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as son of Pharaoh, his daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger." And this is talking about leaving Egypt with the nation of Israel. "He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel." The key to this whole change seems to have been Reuel, who was also known as Jethro. Same names for one person. And it's thought that Reuel has its own meaning. It's thought that Reuel is the name and Jethro is like saying your excellency. But he's known from Jethro from that point on. There aren't a lot of references to him. And yet, at a time when Israel is very far from God and Moses has nothing to do with God's way of life, he was educated in Egypt, except for possibly what his parents might have taught him along the way, it seems that Reuel, Jethro, was the one who was preserving God's truth and God's way of life at this point. He was a priest of Midian. He kept God's ways alive. There's an interesting religion called the Druze religion, D-R-U-Z-E or S-E, and it exists today. It exists in the Middle East. They are an Abrahamic religion. They consider themselves descended from Abraham. They have ties to Islam, but they definitely, strongly do not consider themselves Islamic in any way, shape, or form. They're not Jewish, but they what's the right word, live side by side with the Jews. They're willing to cooperate with them. And it's an odd group in that they still exist today, but you can't join them. Even if you want to, you can't be a Druze. Won't that depress you for the rest of the day? But you have to be descended from one of the people in the 11th century who were Druzes. So you're born into Druzehood. But one of the interesting things about Druzes is they consider Jethro to be their main prophet. They consider him a very wise and spiritual man and devoted to the ways of God. They make visits to what they say is his tomb. Who knows if it is, but they've been calling it his tomb for a long time at this point. And so this is a man who is respected in various parts of the world. By the way, the Druzes also consider Moses, Jesus, they consider them prophets too. They acknowledge all that. They have some awakening that they'll have to do, but it's just interesting how much they revere and respect this man named Jethro, whom you probably don't give much thought to. Look at life from Moses' point of view when he first starts out in Jethro's household. He was a failure. He was a has-been. He was mighty in word and deed. He did marry, but he considered himself a stranger. And yet he was beginning to change. Possibly in the evenings when the sheep were wherever they put sheep, he learned from Jethro, or he learned from talking around the fires, or learned from Jethro's people, learned from the Midianites. It's possible that he learned the creation story and the lives of the patriarchs from Jethro, that Jethro kept those traditions alive. Who knows? Moses didn't get them from Egypt, and yet Moses had them. We know that Moses wrote most of the first five books of the Bible. And yet, when did he write them? Have you ever thought about that? I mean, four of the five take place after they left Egypt. So they must have had materials with them, papyrus, because that was the Egyptian way of doing it. And Moses, unlike his brethren, had been trained to read and write. But when did he start writing these things down? I wonder if it wasn't during these 40 years when he was in a stable place and when he was hearing all these things and thinking these stories are incredible. What are we going to do with them? And they're preserved because Moses wrote them down. All the things about the creation of the earth that we have, the beautiful poetry of Genesis 1, the stories of the patriarchs right up through Joseph. And the story of Joseph, of course, was probably quite alive, even though it had been more than 400 years since Joseph had come to Egypt. He figured they still had his bones. They still had his sarcophagus. So the Jews in Egypt, and including Moses, probably knew quite a bit of the story of Joseph. But did they know the rest? Where did it come from? Where did Moses learn this? Well, of course, God spoke face to face with Moses, and it could have come straight from the mouth of God. But it also could have come from Jethro, who was a huge, huge influence on his life. This is also where he learned humility. We learn when Miriam and Aaron revolt against Moses, we learn that he was the most humble man on earth, and apparently 40 years with the sheep did that for him, because when he spoke to God again, he was a man who had trouble speaking. That isn't questioned. He also grew in faith, so he came to the burning bush at that point. The angel of the Lord appeared to him, which is an interesting expression. Stephen calls it an angel at that point, even though we know it's God himself speaking to him. When angel of the Lord is used, it seems to be an interface that God, who later became Jesus Christ, used to appear on earth. It seems to be like the physical tabernacle that he used. And so this angel of the Lord spoke to Moses, and God gave him his weapons, because that's what the serpent was. When you throw down a snake and it becomes a serpent, people go, ooh, and they back up. When you pull your arm out and you have leprosy, people go, I should be wearing a mask, and they back up at that point. So these were things to give Moses not just power and miracles, but to give him some weapons. God gave him weapons, and Moses had the faith to use them at that point. Now, as I said, Moses could be a bit of a pain in the neck to God. He made God angry with his hesitancies and his lack of faith and his lack of action. And as a shepherd, he had developed some inertia in his life at this point. And there's an interesting story. God has already told him to go to Egypt and make and lead his people out of Egypt. He's already told him what he's going to do to Pharaoh. He's already said Pharaoh won't listen to you. And he's also already said that he is going to kill Pharaoh's firstborn son. He knows that that is absolutely going to happen. We see that down in Exodus 4 and let's start in verse 22. Exodus 4 and verse 22, God speaking to Moses said, "Then say to Pharaoh, this is what God says, this is what the Lord says, Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so that he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son." Right after that, an interesting story takes place. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him. It might say Moses in your Bible, but it says him in Hebrew, and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me," she said. So the Lord let him alone. At that time, she said, "bridegroom of blood," referring to circumcision. And then after that, starting in verse 27, it's as though it didn't happen. God's just cool about the whole thing. What did happen there? Well, God had just spoken about taking the firstborn of Egypt. Moses was going to lead Israel out, but Moses was leaving some things undone that God had told him to do, that in the Abrahamic tradition were important to do if you were going to be not an Egyptian, but if you're going to be an Israelite, and his son was supposed to be circumcised. Now, you get the idea that Zipporah was the one who was against it. You also get the idea from this short story that the love story of Zipporah and Moses was not one of the great romances of the Bible. You get the feeling that they had a functional marriage. And, you know, the other thing, too, is that people think this story is about a baby being circumcised. But this was 40 years after Moses had married this woman, which makes the story even weirder, and I'm not going to go into the details of it. But Moses had left something undone, and God was going to take his firstborn. But Moses took care of it. He was learning how to take care of things and how to be a friend of God. Later on, and this actually is part of the next 40 years, in Exodus 18, we find out that during the events of the plagues and leaving Egypt, that Moses had actually sent his wife and sons away. In Exodus chapter 18, "Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt." And again, I'm assuming you know that story. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, and he must have sent her away after this event because there really wasn't that much time between the event at the inn and now, and her two sons. And we learn something again about Moses' mindset. Of course, we know about the son named Gershon, for Moses said, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." But this is the first mention we get of his second son by name. We know that he had two sons. His second son was named Eleazar, for he said, "My father's God was my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh." So by this time, by the time his second son was born, he was fully aware that God was working in his life. Well, Jethro, verse 5, Moses' father-in-law, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the desert where he was camped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, "I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons." So he was bringing them back. It hadn't been that long. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him. They greeted each other and then went into the tent. By the way, that's the last mention of Moses' wife. It doesn't mention him kissing Zipporah and his two sons. He probably did. I'm not saying that he didn't. But the emphasis is on Moses and Jethro. And Moses told his father-in-law about everything that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the whole story. And in verse 9, Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of Egyptians. And he said, "Praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know," he already suspected, "that God is greater than all other gods, for he did this to those who treated Israel arrogantly." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and other sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law in the presence of God. Then you know the story, which we won't go through, about how Jethro helped Moses figure out some organization in dealing with the day-to-day problems of ruling Israel. And in verse 24, Moses listened to his father and did everything he said, as he had been doing for the last 40 years. And in verse 27, Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country. That's the last we hear of Jethro, and it's the last we hear of Zipporah. Now, the last 40 years. In the last 40 years, Moses grew to understand God even more. God enjoyed Moses. Moses enjoyed God. Moses knew the story of the real Passover. Sometime in those 40 years, he learned that this amazing Yahweh God was going to become a human being and was going to die. And the reason we know that is because when God wanted to give Jesus a gift before his own death and strengthen him, he let him meet with Moses and Elijah. And I don't know what the mechanics were. There's all different thoughts on how what we call the transfiguration on the holy mountain took place, where Jesus took Peter, James, and John and spoke with Elijah and Moses and heard the voice of God the Father at that point. But somehow, regardless of how it happened, Moses, whether he was resurrected or a spirit being or on a Zoom call from his earlier life, who knows at that point, somehow Moses knew, because it says that's what they talked about. And Moses and Elijah encouraged Jesus and said, you got to go through with this. You know, we've been through a lot. You've helped us. This is for you. And Jesus was greatly encouraged by it, it says. And of course, Peter had no idea what was going on, but Moses and Elijah knew what they were there for. And Moses had to have learned that sometime in these 40 years. And at this point, of course, the two stories of the Passover are intertwining. Moses and God's friendship grew. In Numbers 12, it's mentioned that Moses took a Cushite wife. Now, this is in the context of Miriam and Aaron saying, who is this Moses? Who does he think he is? We disagree with him. Why don't people listen to us? And the reason that they used was that Moses had taken a Cushite wife. Now, this was probably 60 or so years after he had married Zipporah. So Zipporah had probably died at this point. People wondered what happened, but, you know, they'd been married a long time. Moses decided to marry a Cushite. What was a Cushite doing in Moses' world at that point? How did she come into his vision? And it's possible that, you know, Moses went on military exploits as a prince, and it's possible that he had known this woman for a long time. They went into the land of Cush, which, by the way, is described fairly complimentarily by Isaiah and other prophets as a land of beautiful people, of tall people. Mentions their skin, beautiful skin people. Probably means, you know, they didn't have a lot of hair like the Israelites did. But I wonder sometimes if this wasn't an old flame that he knew from before the days of Zipporah. And once Zipporah had departed, maybe he rekindled the romance. Whatever it was, God had no objection to it. God doesn't mention the Cushite woman at all. He just says how great Moses is and how humble Moses is. And I speak to Moses face to face. So that was an interesting sidelight. Do you know, sometime in the last 40 years, of course, he actually helped God in a number of ways. As I said, he knew that the great being would become a man, that he would be killed as the true Passover lamb. Do you know that the name Jesus was invented by Moses? It was. You think, well, Jesus, the Hebrew is Yeshua or Yehoshua, and it means God saves. And that's absolutely true. And you think he was named after Joshua, and that also is true. But Joshua wasn't named Joshua. Joshua, when he was born, you can read about it in Numbers 13, was named Hosea, which means saved. And Moses, as God made the man Moses made Joshua. You could say that he created him. He took a young man with a lot of potential. And one of the first things he did was he renamed him. He said, no, I'm going to take the name that God gave me, Yahweh, and I'm going to combine it with your name, Yahweh, Hosea, Yehoshua. And this isn't speculation. This is something that we know that Moses did. Moses made up that name. You know, before Peter Pan, no girls were named Wendy. Everybody you know named Wendy is named after the Wendy in Peter Pan. Everybody you know named Joshua is named after Moses making up the name. And when it came time for God to come up with a name for his son, he thought, well, that's not bad. You know, God saves, delivers. That's a good thing. So he took Moses' creation and gave it to Jesus at that point. Moses managed to work in the last years, the knowledge for his people in combining the two Passover stories, that in Deuteronomy 18:15, that God would be sending a prophet like me from your own people. And this was a person whom Moses knew. And in the days when Jesus lived, and even today, that prophecy is very much alive. Moses made sure that it happened. Moses broke his friendship with God at the waters of Meribah. We know about that, but still at his death, God treated him with great tenderness. And my time is up, so I really can't go in. I could talk to you about this for another hour. How many want to go? I didn't think so. Okay. So let's just say that he was, let's turn to Deuteronomy 34. And we see that God took him to the top of the mountain. They'd already worked out that he was not going into the promised land, but God took him so he could view the promised land, so he could see all that he had worked for in his life. The Lord said to him, "This is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I said, 'I will give it to your descendants.' I have let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over into it." Then Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said. You wondered who wrote these words and who observed these words. Possibly Joshua was with him, or God did speak face to face with Joshua also and maybe gave him that story. Moses is not done growing. We don't know what his role is in the kingdom, but he will have one. We know it probably will have to do with education. In the kingdom, Moses will go into the promised land and see what all the fuss was about. He'll get to see it. One of the great things that I look forward to is seeing the Jews and the Muslims and even the Christians and everybody else find out that Moses had been a Christian all along. You know, can you imagine being Jewish and finding out that Moses was a Christian, that he believed in that? Well, through Moses, the two stories of Passover become one, and they are one also with our own personal story. God made Moses the leader, but he's also making you, every one of you, which is central not just to Passover, but also to unleavened bread, which is about the new man and growing to be the new being that God is making, just as he made a new being out of Moses. As you read the story of Exodus, and you should, I hope you find the time to do it, because there's much more than even we covered today, I hope the things that we have considered today will make it an even richer and more rewarding experience, a gift from God to you.